Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
Also, bookmarked for murder, Dan Andreacco's newest Sebastian McCabe Jeff Cody mystery. Follow Dan's blog, Baker Street Beat, at danandreacco.com.
And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 85, Nicholas Meyer.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burt Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Welcome to Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895.
Why, and so
I'm
is.
Scott Monty.
Yes, and I'm Burt Walder.
How do you do, sir?
Here we are. Fine, here we are indeed.
Well, we've got a great show lined up today. We have an interview with Nick Meyer of the Baker Street Irregulars and, more importantly, of the 7% Solution fame.
Mm-hmm.
That should be a lot of fun. Before we get to that, though, we wanted to remind everyone, if you'd like to get in touch with us, there are a myriad ways to do so. That includes going over to ihearofsherlock.com. That's your headquarters for all Sherlock Holmes news. If you don't want to go there, you can have the news delivered directly to you in your inbox every day. Just sign up and get an email subscription. You can get the daily feed, you can get the weekly feed, or you can get the audio only feed. So you just hear these shows coming in. It's up to you.
And can we get meals on wheels too, along with all those feeds?
Well, you know, again, that's a government program, and it's not that predictable.
Never mind.
So thank goodness I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is not government sponsored.
Hear, hear. Our budget would be cut.
That's true. Speaking of which, well, before we get to that, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, I Hear of Sherlock everywhere you go there. If you want to call, if you want to leave us one of those speaking messages,
oh, please do.
You simply go to 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. Or just record an MP3 into your phone and email it to us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com.
Yeah. Or if you have a camera obscura and the sun is particularly strong, don't hesitate to get some charcoal mists and wave your hands and see if you can make some messages and put that in a empty oatmeal container if you can and just mail that to IHOS, Canton, Michigan, and we'll, I'm sure, get it in a few decades.
There you go. We also have a few thanks to send out. We have some regular contributors. We've got James O'Leary, who is an avid and regular supporter of ours.
Hooray, James!
Thank you for your contribution, James. You're always good to see you popping up in our feed, either as a commenter, as a writer, or as a contributor. We also added John Raby to our list.
Yes.
John, if you don't know, is the son of Bill Raby. Bill was a longtime member of the BSI, and he resided right here in Michigan for quite a few years. Was a member of the Amateur Mendicant Society and handled press relations for, I believe, Mackinac Island, maybe the Grand Hotel.
Oh.
But John is his son, and he works at in public radio out in L.A., so glad to have John on board.
Thank you, John.
And some of our Patreon sponsors at a high level, at the level that gets them mentioned on the air here, include Christian Mongard.
Hooray, Christian.
Thank you for your contribution. Glad to have you on board. And the always delightful and faithful and first to the donation button, Mary Miller.
Yay, Mary.
So thank you, one and all. And if you'd like to help support the production of our show, we would welcome that. Just go on to patreon.com/IHearOfSherlock or just hit the Become a Patron button on our homepage. Any amount that you can afford is fine, but folks, I gotta say, we're probably providing a good deal of value. And even though we don't have tote bags to give away, there are other ways that we thank you for your different levels of generosity. Go over to patreon.com and check it out. Well, for those of us who weren't there, who didn't live through the transition, it may be impossible to understand what it was like. Even for those of us who were, enough time has passed that perhaps memory has dimmed under the successive tides of Sherlockian enthusiasm. But the fact is that 1974 is a watershed year in the history of Sherlock Holmes. That is the year that the great detective went mainstream with the debut of Nicholas Meyer's novel, The 7% Solution.
Mm.
The only Sherlock Holmes stories to rival The 7% Solution for popular success and cultural impact, one could argue, are the original publications themselves of the 60 stories by Arthur Conan Doyle. And we all know that there are high watermarks that are generally thought of in conventional wisdom of occurring once a decade. You know, we had the formalization of the Baker Street Irregulars in the 1940s and the coming of the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce movies. That was the Sherlockian golden age. And then in the 1960s, in England, Douglas Wilmer and Peter Cushing brought Sherlock Holmes to the screen. And of course, in the theaters, you had A Study in Terror and William Baring Gould's annotated Sherlock Holmes. In the mid-70s, you had The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, The 7% Solution, all the way to the late 70s there. And then in the mid-80s through the mid-90s, that was Jeremy Brett's time with the Granada production. And then from about 2009 to present, you've got Robert Downey Jr., Johnny Lee Miller, and Benedict Cumberbatch. But our BSJ Christmas annual for this year says this traditional, conventional wisdom is wrong. That the era ushered in by the 7% Solution has never ended. Since 1974, we've been living in the modern age of Sherlockiana. And who do we have to thank for that, Bert?
I think Frank Lloyd Wright. Because when I think about the modern age, I think about clean lines of design. And personally, if I'm going to feel gratitude for something, I just as soon have it be Frank Lloyd Wright. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's not right. Nicholas Meyer. We have to thank for that Nicholas Meyer.
We do indeed. Do indeed. A little bit about Nick Meyer, if you don't know. He was born in 1945 in New York City. And he began his film career at an early age, as we'll hear. In the fall of 1969, he became unit publicist on the film The Love Story, which spawned his first book, The Love Story Story. And he followed The 7% Solution with two sequels, The West End Horror in 1976 and The Canary Trainer in 1993. He wrote and directed Time After Time, a mystery adventure in which H.G. Wells pursues Jack the Ripper from Victorian England to modern-day San Francisco. And he went on to write and direct Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and a TV movie about the impact of nuclear war called The Day After, and Volunteers. He co-authored Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and directed and co-wrote Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. He was the 1998 Distinguished Speaker at the BSI Weekend, and in 2004 he received his BSI Investiture, a fine Moroccan case.
Mm-hmm. Nicholas Meyer, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Is it okay if we call you Nick?
Yes. In print, I'm Nicholas, but you can call me Nick or Nicky in person.
Excellent.
Or other things.
Other things.
As a member of the BSI, I'm technically a fine Moroccan case.
How about that?
Excellent.
You don't look Moroccan.
It's just my case.
Well, why don't we start where we start with all of our guests and ask you, where did you first meet Sherlock Holmes?
It's harder for me to tell you where than it is when. I imagine I was about 9 or 10 when some gatekeeper drug slipped me a copy of something. I think it was actually A Study in Scarlet, because I remember that when I turned the page and found myself in Utah, I thought, do printers ever make mistakes and like put the wrong books together? I thought, what is this? I was very confused. Nothing has changed.
Well, you weren't alone.
I know that. I've spoken to other, people who began with A Study in Scarlet and thought that was very strange.
So what made you want to keep going after you hit that seeming roadblock of a literary device?
Simply put, I think Arthur Conan Doyle was – I don't. We always call him Conan, which is interesting. Arthur Doyle was incapable of writing a boring sentence. So it really didn't matter what the sentence was about. You just kept – it was like popcorn.
Really grabbed you. Where did you grow up in – now, your father was a noted psychoanalyst who, among other things I noted – wrote a psychoanalytic biography of Joseph Conrad, which is one of the things.
Joseph Conrad and Houdini. My father was interested as a psychoanalyst in the children of the sons, really, of passive or absent fathers. Mm. And Conrad and Harry Houdini, nay, Eric Weiss, fell into that category.
And your mother was a concert pianist, so I gather you grew up in a household full of music and full of ideas and full of books.
Yes, I had no idea that the circumstances under which I was raised, I think every kid just assumes that whatever he's confronted with is like how things are. So I grew up in this hothouse atmosphere of post-war New York. There was back then such a thing as a middle class. And we were part of it. Right. And so I was this little bourgeois kid. I don't know if you ever saw that movie, My Dinner with Andre.
Sure.
And there's this great line where Wally Shawn says that, when he was a kid, he rode around in taxi cabs and all he ever thought about was art. He says, now he's a grown up. He takes the subway and all he thinks about is money. And that was sort of the transition that I made. My mother practiced the piano 8 hours a day, and people came over with instruments and funny looking boxes and played chamber music at night. And the conversation was, I guess, by today's standards, fairly elevated. And I didn't understand all of it, but I got the general drift. Everything they threw at me, I thought was great. I didn't like wearing the only thing is they asked me to wear a tie for certain events. And as a kid, I remember being taken to the Columbia-Harvard game by my dad at Baker Field. He wanted me to wear a tie to go to the football game. And I think that's why I went into the movie business, because I learned you didn't have to wear a tie. Because that was the one thing that they, by the time they had slammed me red-faced and screaming into a tie to go to see some movie about cows for my friend's birthday, I didn't want to see the movie about the cows, and I sure as hell didn't want to wear the tie while I was watching it. But then, you know, once they got me into the Rivoli Theater and I saw Oklahoma, my life was totally transformed. I forgot about the goddamn tie, and I was just like, whoa, this is the greatest thing. So whatever they showed me, I loved.
That's great.
And so you were a great reader, and also
that's still all I do.
Still all you do.
And I'm a slow reader, too.
But
can we get you into a tie for this podcast?
I'm wearing one.
It's too late.
Oh, it looks lovely.
It's the invisible
tie. It looks fantastic.
Yeah. And so you read Round the World in 80 Days and Jules Verne and all these things?
Yeah, my dad introduced me to Jules Verne when I was a kid, and there was this incredible vogue in the 50s for turning Verne books into movies. It started with the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And my friend's mother parked me and my friend in the movie theater and then forgot us for 12 hours. And the film just kept running and we just kept sitting there, at the end of which time we had totally bonded with the mothership. I mean, I never sort of got over that. There is actually a replica of the Disney Nautilus. Can't see it, but trust me, it's here. And then when I was 11, I went for my birthday to see the Mike Todd Around the World in 80 Days, and I had a religious experience. I was like Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus. And in those days, this was a roadshow attraction. You bought tickets, there was an intermission, and there was a program. It cost $2. It was hardcover. It's just out of reach from where we're talking because I still have it. And it was a program about the making of the movie. And there was one article in the program that said – it was a sarcastic article. It was called, "You Two Can Make a Motion Picture, No Previous Experience Necessary." It's about Mike Todd making his movie. And it was the gist of it was, all you need is $6 million and 12,000 people in 5 different countries, and you can make a movie. But I didn't get the sarcasm. I only got the headline. You two can make a motion picture, no previous experience necessary. So I said to my father, "Pop, I want to make a movie." And I, of course, not being the sharpest knife in the drawer, the one I wanted to make was Around the World in 80 Days, the one I just seen. "I will play Phileas Fogg, and Pop, you'll help me," because we have an 8mm wind-up camera.
Right.
And my father, about whom some extremely interesting things can be said, he was sort of a wonderful, he was an amazing guy, and he said, "Okay." And we spent the next 5 years on weekends and on high school vacations and summer, what are holidays, making this Verstunkene movie that eventually was 1 hour and 10 minutes long with sound. And we were obliged to shoot out of sequence, you know, for the convenience of other actors and locations. So I was growing up and down as the movie was put together. It was a little weird. But it was a big hit, and it was something that no matter how bad my teenage years with my father got, you know, the war came to a halt when we were making the movie.
That's fascinating.
So you said it was 5 years that it took you?
Yeah.
So it's like Around the World in 1800 days.
Well, when we finished it, it's pretty coherent and it's pretty cute. And we got written up in Harper's Bazaar at one point, and we used to rent out the print to parties, and kids always loved it. And we edited it on the kitchen table. My mother would come and say, "What is this?"
Put on a tie while you're editing.
Yeah. You know, there are directors who did wear ties. You never see Robert Aldrich without a tie in any of the still photographs.
Hitchcock.
I wore a tie once when I was directing. Right. When I was directing Star Trek II, I wore a tie at a certain point because in Los Angeles, we didn't have our own opera company, and I was an opera fool. But the New York City Opera, now sadly defunct, used to come out for 3 weeks. And it's not like we didn't know the shooting hours on Star Trek II because we were all on sound stages. So there was a quitting time. You know, when I used to tell people I did Star Trek II, they said, oh, were you on location? And I said, yeah, we were 3 weeks on Venus. Anyway, we were on these sound stages, and in those days when you went to the opera, you wore a tie. So the penultimate shot of every shooting day, I would dream up some really crazy thing that would take them 40 minutes to light. And then I would go take a shower and put on my suit and tie and direct the last shot wearing a suit and tie. I got cast in a movie because of that.
See, there you go. So you mentioned at one point about the influence of music in your life. And there's a connection between your fervent interest in Sherlock Holmes and music at a certain point. You want to talk about that?
My family was comprised of a lot of musicians. My Russian-born grandfather was in the Boston Symphony for 25 years. His oldest daughter, my mother, was a concert pianist, as we said. Another son was a flautist and was in the Navy band. And my surviving aunt was a conductor for 40 years and a singer. She was a pupil of Todd Duncan. My oldest sister teaches violin in Beverly Hills. I was surrounded by music. I'm an indifferent pianist myself, but I'm a parlor pianist, and I'm a music fool. I have a large collection, and to show you what an extremely boring person I am, my idea of a good time, I mean, this was seriously how I got my jollies, was to read all the liner notes on the backs of record jackets. And I'll still squint at DVD albums and read that stuff that's shoved in there. I will do that. And I thought of at one point when I was looking for a title for my memoir, I thought I was going to call it Everything I Know I Learned from the Backs of Record Jackets. So, and going back to your question eventually, Sherlock Holmes being a violinist, that struck a chord with me, no pun intended, that it just, that excited my imagination, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and you said that, part of, I think in the Christmas annual, part of the influence, that you had was from a certain Bernard Shaw ripoff. Was it not?
Well, when I was growing up privileged in New York, all the rage was a show called My Fair Lady. Oh my God, the city was mad for this play. And I was no exception. It was fantastic. And I thought, you know, this Henry Higgins, he reminds me of somebody I know. You know, in those days, including my father, all roads led to Sherlock. And I thought, okay, so My Fair Lady is based on Shaw's play, Pygmalion. And I, you know, checked. We didn't have Google then. I don't know how I did it, but I looked up when Pygmalion premiered. And it was right when Sherlock was arguably at the height of his original wave of popularity. And I thought, wait a minute. Sherlock Holmes of 221B Baker Street with Dr. Watson just back from Afghanistan in the house with the landlady, Mrs. Hudson, versus Professor Henry Higgins, even the H in the last name is the same, of 27A Wimpole Street with Colonel Pickering just back from India. In the house presided over by the landlady, Mrs. Pierce, I thought, this is sounding very suspiciously coincidental. I'm like 12, 13 years old when I had this little brainstorm. And so I thought, gee, if the Henry Higgins ripoff made a great musical, wouldn't the original make even better? So I was working up my own, you know, kid version of this, which I was calling Baker Street. I didn't know what else to call it. And I was at a cocktail party with my parents, another occasion when I was slammed into a tie and dragged someplace. I don't know. And I met this guy who was a Broadway producer. And I was like bending his ear with my idea. If I had remotely any of the observational powers of Sherlock Holmes, I might have noticed that this guy was paying real close attention to what I was saying. But of course, I never noticed anything. And a couple of weeks later, and I think it was only weeks, or, I mean, I may have gotten the details of this wrong. It's a long time ago. But I used to come down every morning and grab the New York Times theater section, the movie section, and read it. I had no interest in the outside world at that time. It was just about what was playing and what was gonna play. And my father and I would fight over the paper because he found it obnoxious that I grabbed the whole thing. And I see an article that this Broadway producer is negotiating with the Conan Doyle estate to produce a musical tentatively titled Baker Street. And I don't know what you can say on the air in this conversation, but you know, my head grew to a point, and I said to my dad, I said, Pop, look at this, look at this. You know what I – and he says, well, what do you want? You're a kid. And you shot off your mouth. And
– let that be a lesson to you.
So I was a freshman at the University of Iowa when Baker Street opened with Fritz Weaver as Sherlock Holmes and Martin Gable as Professor Moriarty. I think Inga Swenson was in it too.
Yeah.
And – I never saw it. It got indifferent reviews, but my father did send me a telegram in Iowa. He said, congratulations, knew they couldn't do it without you.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, we had Fritz Weaver as a guest on our show.
Marvelous actor. I saw him in Henry the Fourth, speaking of what we were talking about before.
Ah, very nice. And who, Ray Jessel. Who wrote the music for Baker Street, came to a BSI dinner about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, may he rest in peace.
Yeah, he just passed away. So nice connection. Nice connection. So you lost interest in Sherlock Holmes for a few years, but then it was reinvigorated upon a meeting with someone. You lived across the street from Elaine's in the Upper
next
West
door,
Side.
Not across next door. The street. I next lived next door to Elaine's at a 3-flight walk-up. That, and there was, I could mysteriously never get served there. I guess they couldn't see me behind Marlon Brando. anyway, there was a bar across the street called the White Horse, and I hung out at that place. It was 89th and 2nd or 88th and 2nd. And I should say that my disillusionment with Holmes was not with Holmes, but with, you know, my Baker Street project having gone down or up in flames. I just went off it for a long time, and this was after college. Now, I was in the White Horse Saloon, and I was chatting up a young woman, and we were getting along fine, and somehow the subject of Sherlock Holmes came up. And she suddenly started quizzing me on the details. And I didn't, you know, I'd forgotten. I just been years since I had read the stories. I was 22 years old when this conversation took place. And so I hadn't read them since I was, what, 13 or something. Where was Watson wounded? You know, that's a trick question. And who was
in
Mrs.
Afghanistan?
And Mrs. Very good. Very good. But I was sort of slow on the uptake. Anyway, nothing ever happened with that young woman, but I do remember that I went back and reread the stories. And I really marveled once again at how miraculous these things are. And yeah, some are better than others, but when you think about 60 stories over all those years, it's remarkable how terrific they are. And also how consistent the character of Holmes is. He did not, for example, succumb to the spiritualism that his creator felt as a, you know, or went public with 1916. So I read the stories, and then by merest chance, I came on a book about the books. And that was the beginning of my hopeless, you know, by this time I moved in August of 71. I was in Los Angeles and started collecting in bookstores. Do you remember bookstores? And I would go to bookstores. Yeah,
Amazon just opened one up, believe it or not, in Seattle.
In the Amazon? Oh.
Amazon.com opened a bookstore in Seattle.
I heard that happened, actually. Yeah. I did know that happened. Anyway, I started reading all this stuff, Holmes and music, Holmes and women, Holmes and drugs, Holmes and whatever. And I didn't know why I was reading this. I just couldn't stop. It was, in all cases, anything was preferable to honest labor. So I just kept reading. And one of the things my dad sent me was an article in the Psychoanalytic Quarterly by a Dr. David Musto, and it was about Holmes and Freud. And then I started reading other stuff that had been written even earlier, even by Freud, about how he resembled Sherlock Holmes. There's a case where he says about a patient, he says, "I followed the labyrinth of her mind, Sherlock Holmes-like, until it let, you know." And I think it was a man named Bernard DeVoto who wrote a book called The Tangled Bank, which was about the narrative voice in 19th century English literature. And he compared and contrasted Holmes's or Watson's narrative voice with Freud's. And anyway, these things began to, shall we say, gel. And I kept concocting this story that I said I would write one day. And I was just starting out in Los Angeles and trying to get, you know, employed writing movies, and ultimately my goal was to direct them. And just as I started having some traction and was writing movies of the week for network television, the Writers Guild, of which I was, you know, then and now a member, went on strike. And you weren't allowed to write screenplays. At which point, the woman with whom I was living said, "Well, now you can write that Sherlock Holmes novel you're always talking about." And she was right, because aside from picketing the Goldwyn Studios for 3 hours in the baking sun every day, we were all acting in our own version of Waiting for Lefty. I had nothing to do but write it, so I wrote it.
And you have a very interesting method for writing.
Is it?
Well, different from certainly what we know today. You know,
what do we know?
Well, word processing and, you know.
Legal pens.
And, you know, missing the analog process. You know, I mean, how many things get changed in post-editing in electronic documents now versus what you did, which was writing everything out by longhand on yellow legal pads? Why would you do that rather than using your Smith Corona or other notebooks?
I started typing it. I started using a Smith Corona electric typewriter, which I had, and that's how I would write. And then you would get out the whiteout and the scotch tape and do the whole thing, which eventually happened. But what I discovered, first of all, I just want to, you know, go on the record as saying that how people create, how people write is inevitably as individual a process as how they fall asleep at night. Do you lie on your back? Do you lie on your side? Do you wear a little thing clutching your nose? Do you wear a sleep mask? Do you wear earmuffs? Everybody does it, gets there differently. Because it's in sleeping or creating, it's about letting go and letting sort of something come out to play that, and it was cumbersome analogy maybe, but some people write longhand to this day. Some people write in the morning. Some people write in the afternoon. Some people can listen to music while they write. Some people can't. I can't. The point was I was writing screenplays, and the typewriter worked very well for me for writing screenplays. But when I was trying to write like Doyle, the results were not coming out right. I should remark parenthetically that I had this enormously hubristic idea based on the fact that I never liked any Sherlock Holmes imitations that I'd ever seen or read. I hated the movies. I couldn't stand them. I thought Basil Rathbone was probably a great Sherlock Holmes, or would have been if they'd ever let him play Sherlock Holmes. But they always had him with Nigel Bruce as Dr. Watson, and I thought, you know, why does a genius hang out with an idiot?
Bert.
Am I supposed to believe that Nigel Bruce is the guy who wrote down the stories that I grew up loving? So I had this very sort of purist orientation. Later on, there were a couple of Holmes movies that I really liked. But at that time, I think the only one that I could bear that I liked was the Peter Cushing Hound of the Baskervilles, which seemed to be fairly straightforward, no-nonsense Sherlock. So my hubristic notion was that I, and only I, could connect with the inner Doyle, the inner Holmes thing. I started from that notion that everybody else was doing it wrong. So imagine my chagrin when this Smith Corona electric typewriter was not yielding the right sound. And that's when I thought, you know, maybe you have to do this with a pen. And that's what I did.
Yeah. But beyond the pen, you know, there's an interesting part about your writing process that's not unique. I mean, I know you may still be an avid reader of The New Yorker, and it's a similar writing process, I think, that John McPhee follows, in that, as I understand it, what you did was go back to the canon, reread each of the stories, and then starting, you know, page one, here's what happens on page one, making notes. So you had a very, as I understand it, research-intensive process.
What's interesting is that it wasn't until I read Stephen Doyle's article that is coming out in the BSJ Journal that he had gone back
right
to my papers at the University of Iowa Library and found how I had done this, because I sure didn't remember. And memory is a funny thing. Just to digress for a second and bring in the University of Iowa and their amazing ability to organize whatever it was from my wastebasket that I've been sending them over the years, is that somebody asked me, talking about Star Trek, did you have a lot of contact with Gene Roddenberry on Star Trek II, on The Wrath of Khan? And I said, no, I didn't think so. I think by that time you just sort of met him and, you know, kissed the ring and because he didn't have anything to do with the making of the movies that I was involved with. And then I was back in Iowa City, which I visited regularly, and they showed me in my collection an enormous and not entirely pleasant correspondence of memos between me and Gene Roddenberry about how much he didn't like, you know, whatever I was doing when I wrote The Wrath of Khan. He, you know, all these objections and my impatient, you know, responses to it. And I had completely blocked out that this had ever happened. And I said, oh, yeah, I met him, you know, briefly, and that was it. And that's wrong. Memory is deceptive.
It's true.
You know, in my memoir, which I'm happy to say is still available, I think the first line of the memoir is about lawyers and cops will tell you that eyewitnesses are the least reliable witnesses, and that the movie Rashomon, you know, celebrates this whole paradox of how we differently remember things. So, yeah, I didn't remember anything about writing the book except that I had to do it in longhand.
But basically that process, as you said in the annual, it forced you to learn the material, to learn the style, to learn the facts, etc. You became a student of Doyle's, basically.
There was a guy who copied out all of War and Peace by hand so he could say that he wrote War and Peace.
Yeah.
Which, funnily enough, the actual writing of most of that was, I mean, if you want to look at it from that point of view, it was Tolstoy's wife who wrote it 6 times.
Wow. Poor woman.
It was the happiest time of her life. It was the happiest time of her life. He would write something, and then she couldn't make out a word. And she would say, "What's this word?" And he would say, it doesn't matter. Just put in anything. And she goes, no. You crossed it out and rewrote it 3 times. It must be important. And she was like a detective looking around. And as long as he was writing, they had a great marriage because she knew he was a genius. And then when he stopped writing and started thinking, she said, "What are you doing? You're thinking. That's not your thing, Leo." So, yeah, I must have written down a lot of stuff so I could pretend to be Doyle.
So after you had handwritten it out, you felt like you had the style. How did you know? How did you come upon it and say, "Aha, this is it. I've actually nailed it."
Well, I used to read what I had written to my girlfriend at night. After dinner, typically, she'd be washing dishes, I'd be drying them. And so I would read her what I'd written that day. And my memory, again, we put it in quotation marks, like the word reality, which Nabokov always said should be in quotation marks, the reality, is my memory is that I was reading it and she said, "Stop." I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I forgot it was you."
Wow.
And then I thought, "Oh, this is getting good." You know, not anticipating anything about the book at that point, but just that I had.
You got the style right.
That the style was getting right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Books dedicated to her, actually.
Now, whatever happened to Sally? Well, of course, you've been wondering when we were going to hit your eardrums with this one.
Ow.
I'm sorry. Ow, I did it again.
A snare drum. My ears are snared.
Well, we hope to be a little more delicate,
yes,
with you regarding it, because it's stuff you really need to hear.
You know,
we've got sponsors that, you know, it's not an earful of stuff that is annoying. You know, really, it's part of why you listen to the show. It's the commentary. It's the original writings. It's the pastiches.
Man.
All of that you can get, interestingly enough, from the Wessex Press.
My goodness. In one place? That's amazing.
Isn't it?
And just look what they have there, dedicated to the study of Sherlock Holmes and his world. 221 BBC, writing for the world's only complete dramatized canon and beyond by our pal Bert Cools. You can get that. You can get the Drury Lane Theater Mystery, an original Sherlock Holmes screen treatment by Dennis Hoey, who played Inspector Lestrade in the films. You can get A Study in Celluloid, a producer's account of Jeremy Brett as Sherlock Holmes. And if you want to cast yourself back to 1910, the illustrated Speckled Band, you can get the original 1910 stage production and script and photographs of the play, the Speckled Band, by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I've heard of him. Edited by Les Klinger.
That's some amazing stuff.
Yeah. Now, that's sold out, but it will be available very soon. Very soon.
And as we get closer to the BSI weekend, you'll be hearing about exclusive offers and things that are available in early January and beyond. So
yes.
Go over to WessExpress.com, check them out, and tell them that iHose sent you.
Yeah.
And, of course, mentioned at the top of the show, we have an extra sponsor this time around. It is none other than our good old friend Dan Andriacco.
God bless him.
I know. Dan's fantastic. So, Dan, a fellow bow tie fancier, which we appreciate. And also a member of this group that's I'm blanking on it right now. I'm going to pull it up on Facebook. When I was at Scintillation of Scions 7, a year and a half ago, Dan and team were down there. They're manning the tables, selling books and all the like. And a number of us realized that we were all Catholics. And Dan is a leading Catholic. He put together a group called the Vatican Cameos.
Oh, how great!
Of Catholics who are Sherlockian, so they have some regular ceremonies and meetings and whatnot. I haven't been able to attend one, but I just thought it was neat that they kind of identified that common interest and put it together. And Dan was certainly behind that. But we're not here to tell you about Dan and his Catholicism. We're here to tell you about Dan and his writing. Of course, Sebastian McCabe and Jeff Cody are back once again in Bookmarked for Murder. You can get that through Amazon and purveyors of fine books. And even our friend Roger Johnson over at the Sherlock Holmes Society of London has taken a look at it, and he said it's a real cracker. if Cody is Watson, McCabe is perhaps less Sherlock Holmes than a sort of sociable Mycroft. This is excellent, intelligent entertainment. That's great to have Roger's thumbs up on that. And our friend Bonnie McBird, who joined us just a couple of episodes ago to talk about Art in the Blood, said about the previous McCabe-Cody book, Rogue's Gallery, "You're in the hands of a master of mystery plotting here. Rogue's Gallery is a delightful read, hard to put down, and highly recommended." So whether it's Bookmarked for Murder or Rogue's Gallery, check those out. And also, of course, you may recall that Dan, together with Kieran McMullen, have the Enoch Hale trilogy, three novellas set in 1920s. London, and they actually involve Sherlock Holmes as a character, not a Sherlock Holmes-like character, but Sherlock Holmes himself. And the final installment there is The Egyptian Curse. So check all those out on Amazon and, of course, on Dan's blog, Baker Street Beat, at danandriaco.com. And if you'd like his page on Facebook, it's Dan Andriaco Mysteries. So thanks for being a part of our show once again, Dan.
And also, we are brought to you by the beautiful, the reliable, the resilient, the lavender-scented, the lanolin-containing Baker Street Journal, the waterproof and beautifully stapled Baker Street Journal, which, among other things, for you happy, lucky subscribers, this year you will be getting the Christmas annual and learning all about the 7% solution, which we are in the middle of discussing with our pal Nick Meyer. But it's not too late to get more subscriptions.
It isn't.
You know, and in fact, I frequently observe this, you know, as we all become more forgetful. You don't want to leave this thing in a taxi somewhere. Get two or three subscriptions so that you're always got a copy handy.
I like your thinking.
Yeah.
I've actually done that before with some of my prized Sherlockian possessions. I've left them in hotel rooms, in airline seat backs. Some of them I have been fortunate enough to reclaim.
Oh.
Others not so much. And I've had to go get a second copy. So, and fortunately, they were things that were not out of print yet.
Good.
Not always the case with all of these publications.
Yes. First editions should not be going out of the house.
Not at all. Learn that the hard way. Now, whatever happened to Sally?
She went up on a tower with a machine gun. At the no, that wasn't fun. I think
that's a great
that
song.
She became a Protestant minister of some denomination.
Wow. I thought you were going to say she became a literary critic or eventually your wife or something like that, but... Not so
no.
Hollywood.
To the best of my memory, she did not become my wife.
Okay.
Memory.
Well, memory's a funny thing. You know.
The University of Iowa. And
She may be in a box at the University of Iowa.
By the way, I was just in Iowa City maybe 2-3 weeks ago.
I was there.
You were?
Homecoming.
I missed you.
I was there. I took my youngest daughter to visit the campus for homecoming.
Okay.
And we watched them play Illinois. Here's the thing. I don't understand a lot about sports, but I do know that the football team is undefeated so far this year. And it is mysterious to me that our 11-0 record is not being celebrated anywhere. There's not a single headline devoted to it. You have to just look at the rankings to see, oh, yeah, they're still winning.
Yeah, there they are. Yeah. So you've got your finished product. You've got what you want to market as a book, your manuscript, your only copy. How do you go about getting yourself representation?
Well, he had representation.
Well, I must have made a couple of copies. I was represented by a movie agency. They had an East Coast office, which they had literary departments. So I mailed my manuscript to a lady there, and after, I don't know, giving her 15 minutes to read it, I was very impatient. I called her and I said, well, because I thought at the end of it, I thought, well, this is publishable. I thought somebody will publish this. I've read worse books than this. And she sort of said something like, well, you know, I've never read any Sherlock Holmes, so what's the point of my reading this? Because I couldn't tell if it was any good. And maybe I'm more tactful now, but probably not like a lot after 40 years. And I said, well, putting aside the fact that you call yourself a literary agent, but you've never read any Arthur Conan Doyle, I can tell you that if this book depends on another book, it's doomed. And I thought this was an unassailable argument, except she'd rung off by then. So she never got to hear it. I think I lost her after the phrase, you call yourself a literary agent. Probably it was the cutoff point. And so, I had not lived in Los Angeles for a very long time, but I had been invited to dinner by a nice person. And I met this guy who said he was an entertainment lawyer. I didn't know what an entertainment lawyer was. I thought maybe he was a lawyer who tells jokes or something. he sort of described what he did, and I said, oh, well, if I ever need an entertainment lawyer, would you be my lawyer? And he said, sure. And neither of us knew what we were talking about. But now I didn't know what to do with my book. I knew one person from when I had lived in New York who was in the publishing business. It was a guy named Jim Niederlander who had been at Macmillan, and I had met him. So I took a copy of the book, the copy I had left, and I flew to New York, which like took all the money I had, and went to Macmillan to see him to give him my book. It, for some reason, did not occur to me, or else I dismissed the reason, to call him up and give him some advance notice of my intention. I just was there. And it was pouring rain. That I remember, because I was soaking. I was standing in the reception area of Macmillan, and they said he didn't work there anymore. And I mean, I'm dripping. I'm thinking because I didn't understand. I'm a kid. I didn't understand that, you know, people in life make lateral moves. They do everything. They go in and out of it. Because I've never made a lateral move in my life. I tell stories. It's the only thing I know how to do, period, the end. There's nothing else I can do, so forget it. So I said, well, is he still in the publishing business? And they said, oh, let me look. Oh, yeah, he's at a place called Hawthorne. I said, do you have the address? They gave me the address, and I go out in the rain, and I find him. And he's a little bewildered to see me. And I explain I've written a novel. He goes, oh.
Good news.
Said, like
good
a
news.
Goat bleating. And I said, what? I said, well, I'd like to give you my novels if you want to publish it. And he said, well, I've tried to publish 5 novels since I've been here. This is a nonfiction house.
Well, Sherlock Holmes, it's true to life, right?
I didn't know what to do. I was out of, you know, string. I just said, look, here it is. Just take a look. Maybe you can suggest a place to go with it or something. And I got back on the plane and flew home. And I had been back in L.A. about 5 days. Again, this is my memory. So was it 2 days? Was it 15 days? I don't know. He calls me up and he says, this one they'll publish. And I said, they will? He said, yeah. So I said, and he named a number of the advance, which seemed an astronomical figure to me. And I said, okay, I have to get back to you. So I called my entertainment lawyer and I said, listen, I found a publisher for – I wrote a book. I had to explain everything. I wrote a book. I found a publisher for my book, but I really don't relish the idea of the agency that refused to read, let alone represent the book, getting 10% for negotiating the deal. I'll give you 10%. And he said, well, let me read the book. So he reads the book and he calls me back and he says – Hawthorne is a nonfiction house. You could do better. And I said, you don't understand. He said, they just are offering me like the moon here. And he said, just let me try one, you know. And I said, what am I going to tell Jim? And he said, he'll understand, believe me. And so Tom Pollack, that was his name, and he subsequently went on to represent George Lucas and Arnold Schwarzenegger and a lot of, you know, he became head of Universal. It was a big stellar career, but I was like his first, you know, major success. So then they went, he sold it to Harcourt Brace-Jovanovic, and it sort of floundered around there, and that was when my problems with the Conan Doyle estate began. That avaricious collector's agency. Did I say collector's? I should say collection agency. It was no 7% solution, I can tell you. But I didn't have the money to, I didn't know anything about copyright. I thought, you know, it doesn't look like it's in copyright to me. And somebody said, where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise. If I had known how difficult this was going to be, I probably wouldn't have written the book.
You're the second person who has told us that exact phrase, who has mentioned that exact phrase to us in the last week.
The other one is Mitch Cullen.
Did you read our piece today? We have an in-depth
– long article in a newspaper.
Well, that was yesterday in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. We had an exclusive in-depth interview with Mitch on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere that just aired or we just published today.
Oh.
And well, he has quite a few turns of phrase about the Conan Doyle estate and its processes.
I wouldn't be surprised. A very sort of disillusioning process because there are several things involved here. One is the law. One is justice. As we know, these are not synonymous. It's not synonymous.
Right.
And the somewhat cynical attitude about easier to make the deal than have the fight is sad. You know, it's like – and I was watching last night on CNN this amazing documentary called The Hunting Ground. I don't know if you saw it. But this is all about how college athletics trump, no pun intended, I don't think, justice. So that women who are sexually assaulted by star football players, forget it.
No.
Forget it. There's just too much money at stake. and easier to, you should pardon the expression, play ball. And I certainly was in no position to contest the Doyle estate. And by the way, they may have even been right that the copyright, you know, conventions did exist that, and were enforced. So it was a long process.
I was surprised in reading the Christmas Annual and the story of this as it eventually got to Dutton, where it was finally published to great acclaim, how many editors or people you encountered who didn't get the voice. I remember one editor said, I think at a previous house, maybe it was at Harcourt, said, you know, basically what he said was, this sort of needs to be made easier for the modern reader. And I found that very surprising.
Well, I can't honestly say there was a what you might characterize as a procession of editors. There was this editor at Harcourt Brace. He was a lovely man, and he was a very capable guy. And yes, he entertained that thesis that the book, which was written in a very punctilious and loyal imitation of Doyle, with whom millions of readers seemed to have no problem, incidentally, that it needed to be simplified in some way. Here's a dilemma. You're a first-time novelist. You've written a novel. It's your first novel. And a very experienced book editor says to you, no, here is what you must do. So it's basically your gut versus his knowledge. And I think a lot of people, including me at a later date with another book, succumb to that logic. In the case of the 7% solution, I got really lucky. And the lucky thing was I was a forger. And I knew what I was forging. I had a model. Whereas if I had written a totally original novel that was someone, you know, was advising me to, you know, to significantly change, I might have said, well, I, you know, because I didn't know what it was supposed to be, and maybe he knew better, and maybe I was dealing with Maxwell Perkins or Maxfield, whatever, Perkins Parish. I know it's a, and, but in the case of my book, I knew what it was supposed to sound like. And so I said, you know, I see what you're doing, but now it doesn't sound like Doyle anymore. So, and in the book world, the author has the last word, unlike the dinner table.
Or like directing or screenwriting, where it's a team effort, right?
Yeah.
So before we get to the screen version of the 7% solution, let's just recap. You know, the book is published. It is a major runaway success. 44 straight weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Is that right?
Yeah, I think. Yeah. Maybe it was 40. Because, okay. Of course, who was keeping score? Well, right. But yes.
The better part of a year. It is successful beyond your wildest imaginations.
That's, of course, totally true, since I was incapable of imagining anything along those lines. Why should I? There was no precedent. I had never succeeded at anything.
Yeah. And at a certain point, you get a communication from one Dr. Julian Wolfe, BSI, to come to the BSI dinner in New York.
Well, yeah, it was my fantasy. My whole fantasy while I'm writing the book was not that it was going to be anybody's bestseller, but that I would be made a member of this organization to which I dreamed of belonging.
Sure.
It was just arcane enough to be my style.
You dreamed of belonging to it, but you didn't know there weren't any women in those days.
Well, there were women. They just
weren't, you know, at the dinner.
You've listened to Mel Brooks, the 2,000-year-old man who discovered the woman, Bernie, because one day he woke up smiling. Well,
there's women here.
He goes, hey, there's ladies here. And then he went into such a story that even 2,000 years later, what? No, there was women, but they, you know, I had this fantasy that, okay, my fantasy was, my first fantasy was that I would be invited to join. And my, and of course, I guess as a kind of corollary to that fantasy is that I would be invited to the dinner. And I would find some stunningly beautiful girl and take her to New York and impress the hell out of her by going to this dinner. So I ordered two tickets. And this gentleman whom I never got to meet, and he seemed to communicate by postcards.
Yes.
And he wrote back, may I ask whom you are bringing? I assume you know that women do not attend the meetings. Well, that was my whole fantasy, was just went down the tubes of being a big shot. So I, again, not always the most diplomatic, I lacked the skills of a Talleyrand. And I said, no, I didn't know that women do not attend the meeting. Do Jews? And
now you do know that Julian was Jewish.
How would I know that?
Well, now, I mean.
Well, now I know, now it, but I know. Mean, you know, I didn't, who knew it? So he wrote back and he said.
So he attended the meeting, but he only stood outside. You know, he didn't.
I didn't know. And he wrote back and he said, it's a tradition. And I just said, so is lynching.
Glad you never made it into the diplomatic corps.
You know, I
or the BSI until the 1990s.
So I flunked out, and I decided not to attend. The restricted policy troubled me. And first it troubled me in a purely selfish, egomaniacal, I can't bring a great-looking lady to this. And then I started to get civic-minded and thought, what is this? Mm. Who else can't attend?
Well, we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of women first getting their BSI investitures. So,
I was invited some years later to a dinner, and I thought, oh, screw it. Just go. See what it is. So I went, and I had a great time. And then at the end of the evening, around midnight, they said, now we're all going to this bar. I can't remember where the bar was. I want to say it was in Grand Central Station, but I'm not sure. And I said, what's at the bar? And they goes, well, we meet up with the adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes. I said, what's that? And they said, that's the ladies' contingent. I said, oh, I'm there. Okay, let's do that. So we go, and there's all these lovely ladies at the bar and whatever. And I said, so what happened at your meeting? And they said, well, a lady came in and did an exhibition of Victorian underwear. I said, what? Yeah, you know, fully dressed as a Victorian lady and then sort of disrobed. I said, you had a stripper? You had a stripper at your meeting? I was at the wrong meeting. Do you accept? Do you take boys?
That story, actually, that it was a reverse stripper. It was Marina Stajic, who's also a member of the BSI, who came in her underwear and proceeded to get dressed in front of everyone to show how time-consuming Victorian garb, putting on Victorian garb was. It took her 30 minutes to go through the entire process.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Then you bring her over to the BSI and have her take it off. Yeah, but Marina, a great Sherlockian scholar and a... She was the lead toxicologist for the city of New York for many years.
Hmm. So yeah, she knows her way around an autopsy, Marina.
So you eventually did speak at the BSI weekend. You were the first distinguished speaker, I believe, when we started that tradition up, 1998.
Is that true?
I think so.
Any of it? Yeah. Okay. All right.
All of it.
You were there. We have photographs.
Yeah. At least 75% of it. And then you were finally given the honor of an investiture in the BSI in 2004.
I mean, my eyes are watering as we're talking. This is not a small thing. I waited a very long time.
You did.
And and the only letters that I'm entitled to put after my name
are BSI.
Which I do at every opportunity is BSI.
That's wonderful. And I mean, you talk about delayed gratification. You know, and you were the reason that so many Sherlockians came into the fold in the 1970s, 1980s, and beyond. And I think Steve Doyle makes a great case that, you know, we pick out certain occurrences or certain icons in each decade, and that kind of symbolizes where Sherlock Holmes got an additional boost, whether it's Rathbone in the 40s or Jeremy Brett in the 80s. And a lot of times 7% Solution is picked out for the 70s. And his supposition was that it's really never ended. You know, the 7% Solution is something that obviously started in the 70s, but that has had a sustained impact on the world of Sherlock Holmes because it is such a well-written book, a pastiche bar none, that rivals the tales of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle himself.
I'm obviously not the most objective person you could talk to on this subject, but...
Thankfully, you're not the most humble person either, so, you know, let's have it.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you like it?
Do I like the book?
Yeah.
I like the book. I think it's a good book. You know, I didn't tell myself I'd written the great American novel, but I thought, this is fun, you know, and...
It's great.
That was my – but, the, you know, the New York Times some a couple years ago wrote an article amid the Sherlock Holmes boom that basically preceded Steve Doyle's thesis by a couple of years and said, here's the book that really, you know, brought him back from the dead. Or for people who never had heard of him, this was it. And I'm happy to take credit for that's my little, you know, contribution to Western Civ, whatever. So there were two more Holmes pastiches again during this period. One was the West End Horror, and in the 90s, the Canary Trainer. So, yeah, I mean, it's like a maybe not the world's biggest claim to fame, but. I think that the case can be made that those books played a role in popularizing and bringing in a whole new audience.
Certainly. So you get over to the cinematic side, and the movie rights were signed fairly quickly after the book was completed, and the movie was made and put into the cinema in very short order. That's not too common in this day and age.
Well, in this day and age, it's especially not common. I think it was arguably more common. I mean, how long did it take for Jaws to become a movie? I don't know. It was the same years.
You know, it took The Great Gatsby a few years. You know, that's for the Great American Novel, you know.
When was the Alan Ladd version of The Great Gatsby?
Because
that was the first one.
Yeah.
I had a friend who edited Star Trek II, and he edited The Day After for me. And he had a production company of his own, and it was called Miracle Pictures. And their sobriquet was, if it's a good picture, it's a miracle. and how movies get made and when they get made and why they get made – you know, to give you an example, John Huston always wanted to make a movie of Kipling's The Man Who Would Be King.
Right.
And the first time he wanted to make it, he had Humphrey Bogart and Clark Gable lined up to play Danny and Peachy.
Right.
And that didn't happen. And then he had Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole to play Danny and Peachy. And it didn't happen. And then finally, you know, he got Sean Connery and Michael Caine. And similarly, the Maltese Falcon which was made into a movie, I think, at least twice.
Oh, more than that, I think, yeah.
But before Houston nailed it.
Right.
There was a silent, I think there was a silent Maltese, I'm not sure, but there was an earlier sound version, which is simply ghastly.
Yeah, with Gutman, I think the Gutman character is a female in that one, isn't that right?
Well, those are the kind of license that, you know, me as a filmmaker, I don't have that kind of problem. Well, my bigger problem is that earlier movie entirely missed the character of what's his name's book,
Dashiell Hammett.
Dashiell Hammett, sure.
It didn't capture it, and that's goes back to, you know, sort of where we came in about the Holmes movies that I just never, you know, I got offered at one point to do something called Young Sherlock Holmes, and I went to meet the producer, and I said, What's the movie? And he said, well, it's about how Holmes and Watson met at public school when they were kids. And I said, no, they didn't. So I was out of that movie.
Yeah.
So the casting for the movie was really something. We had Alan Arkin, Robert Duvall, Sir Laurence Olivier, Vanessa Redgrave. I mean, these are screen legends of varying shapes and sizes.
Hmm.
What was that like on your end to see your work come to life through the artistry of these legendary actors?
Well, at this point, my life had turned into a fantasy. You know, I was having like dissociative experiences where I was like watching a movie in which I had a kind of a walk-on role. I really didn't, because on the one point, as the screenwriter, and by the way, the screenwriter much deferred to by the director Herb Ross, and who was I had a great time working with him, and I had to make believe like I was a professional, and this was grown up stuff, and you had to act normal, and you couldn't be bouncing off the walls, going, "Are you kidding me?" You know? So we would meet every day in Herb's office, and we would talk about, you know, casting the movie, and I remember that the big goal in casting the movie was to make audiences look at these people fresh. We didn't want Colonel Blimp. We didn't want Rathbone, all the stereotype stuff that I had written my book in protest of. Sorry about the preposition. So, for example, I mean, Freud, yeah, Alan Arkin, my idea. I just think he's such a great actor. And then we heard that Robert Duvall was interested in playing Dr. Watson, and everybody went, "What?" And I said, wait a minute, you don't get it. This is a great, great actor, and he's interested in playing in our movie. You're not even going to, you know. So movie stars do not audition. They meet.
Yes.
We had a meeting. And so Robert Duvall came down to MGM, which was where Herb had his office, to meet. And he actually walked in a buckskin fringed jacket and speaking with an Appalachian twang, because I guess that same day he was meeting about possibly playing Woody Guthrie in the movie Bound for Glory. So he came in as Woody Guthrie.
I heard he wore the Dr. Watson costume to the Woody Guthrie audition.
Would have been funny. Anyway, the thing was that Herb Ross, who was married to the ballerina Nora Kay, who was arguably America's greatest dramatic ballerina, she was unbelievable. When you met her, she talked like Fanny Bryce. She was from the Lower East Side. She had a very thick New York accent, and he never made a move without her. She had really quarterbacked his career from being a dancer to being a choreographer to being a choreographer for movies and then becoming a director. He would never make a big decision without touching base with her. And they had been fighting all morning on the phone. They'd been hanging up on each other. Norm, hanging up now. You know. So Duval comes in and sits and chats, and we have no idea what to make of him as Woody Guthrie. And he finally gets up to leave, and he pulls out a cassette. And he said, I brung you this cassette so you can see how I'm talking as Dr. Watson. And he leaves. And we listen to the cassette, and out comes, you know, a very passable Oxbridge accent. And I said, look, he could do it. He could do it. And he goes, wait, I have to play for Nora. He picks up the phone. I'm on the extension. And he calls his wife at home, and he goes, Nora, listen to this. Can you tell that this person is in English? And he plays the thing. And remember, they're fighting. And she says, Herbert. This is how she thought. Who is that? Is that Mel Brooks? You want to throw the picture in the turlet? Just cast turlet. That poison. So he hangs up. He's dismayed. And I'm seeing my actor get away. And I said, can we call another person?
Poison.
And so he – oh, and she had said, yeah, call Sam. Ask an English person. So Sam is Samantha Eggar, lovely British actress who was a friend of theirs. She's in The Collector with Terrence Stamp. And she went on to play Mrs. Watson in the movie. So the, he says the same thing. Can you tell this person isn't English? And she listens and she goes, well, he's trying too hard, isn't he? It's very good, but he's trying too hard. I said, Herb, can we talk to one other English person? And this time, can I ask the question? And he says, okay. So we start looking for an English person. It was a Friday. This is my memory, is it's a Friday. And all the English assistants that all the executives have, they all like to have English assistants, have gone. And we finally find this one English assistant to an executive. And I say, we're having an argument here. Is what we're listening to South African or Australian? Something like that. Is this New Zealand or Australian?
Good question.
And she listens and she goes, oh, that's English. That's Oxbridge. And that's how we got the part.
Nice. It's and all about English, phrasing the question.
A lot of English persons think he doesn't do a good job, but I think he did. And I also think that he almost steals the movie anyway.
Yeah. It's a remarkable performance. Really was.
Yeah, he was great. And the weird thing is that in dailies, you couldn't see him doing anything. And I'm – because he would just like stand there and say a line. And I'm saying to Herb, I'm tugging him on the sleeve. I said, okay, you got to get him to emote. So Herb tries talking to Duval, who is a, shall we say, prickly individual. And he goes, what do you want me to do? Make faces? So we backed off. We didn't know. And then when you stitch the whole thing together, there it is.
The stalwart Watson.
Yeah. A guy who could have written down the stories.
Yeah.
And how did Vanessa Redgrave come to join the cast? And what was it like working with her?
She was a delight. No one would work with her because at that time she was championing the plight of Palestinians.
Right.
No one quite understood, maybe they still don't, what those people are going through. But she was out there really proselytizing. And in Hollywood, that was anathema. And so it was not that hard to get her. And she was lovely.
She's magnificent. There's a couple of scenes there where she just lights up the screen.
Yeah. Well, you believe, you know, that she's like this, you know, it's not a big part. It's just, but it required some luminescence or luminosity or something. Mm. She
So, obviously, when you bring a book to the screen, when you adapt a book for the screen, there are certain things that need to give, or there are certain things that need to be added. And Bert and I were talking before the show, and we wanted to hear more about the tennis match scene.
Well, you
mentioned in the annual how it seemed so obvious and it was just a great addition, but you missed it for the book. You want to talk about the process and how it all came about?
Well, the book was the tennis scene was literally a scene that I dreamed after the book had gone to the publisher and they were going to publish the book. And I woke up one morning and I had dreamt that two characters were playing tennis. And I lay there in bed staring at the ceiling wondering, you know, Holmes and Freud and Watts, who was playing tennis? And it was just like – it just – and then I finally sort of doped it out into something that seemed really good. And I wrote it. It was like 4 pages or something. And I called Yuri Djurjevics, who was my editor at the Dutton Press, and they were the publishers of the book. And I said, you don't get to say this a lot. Stop the presses. And I threw in my tennis scene. And it had a nice payoff at the end because when Holmes is dueling the Baron, you know, he says no backhand, and that's how Holmes beats the Baron. The thing about doing an adaptation, whether it's your book or anybody else's, you really have to be kind of ruthless about what – the idea is not to make the coffee table edition of the book, the illustrated edition of the book. You need to make something that, if you'd never read the book, it's a great movie. You see Gone with the Wind. I never read the book, but I can tell, you know, at least 3/4 of it is pretty amazing. Yeah. Or another example, The Manchurian Candidate. It was years before I read Richard Condon's book, but the movie is a jaw-dropping thing. And you have to be ruthless. And if I were to make my own critique of the novel, The 7% Solution, and an artist, I have to preface this by saying, is or should not be regarded as in any way a more authoritative judge of his work than anybody who experiences it, the reader, the viewer, the listener. It's just another opinion. The artist loses all proprietary authority of the work when it's finished. Then it's just out there, and people are going to make of it what they're going to make. So this is just another opinion. But my opinion of the book was that the mystery wasn't maybe as good as the idea of the rest of the book, is that I wished that I was better at writing mysteries. So I thought, well, the movie will give me an opportunity to maybe write a better mystery. And there was another reason for doing this as far as I was concerned, and that is if you write a mystery story and then you make the mystery story into a movie and everybody's read the mystery, then they're going to know this. You know, I remember when I watched Presumed Innocent and I'd read the book, so I knew Bonnie Bedelia did it. Sorry, that's a spoiler for anybody who's not done either. But anyway.
But she didn't do it in the book.
Yeah, she did.
The actress.
Well, it wasn't Bonnie Bedelia. It was the wife. Okay. So anyway, I thought, well, so here's a chance to, you know, take people a little bit by surprise. And so I redid the thing. And when it came time to do the tennis match, my gut said, gee, the whole movie's going to stop while you watch two guys play tennis. I thought this is like a bad idea. And I said to Herb, we shouldn't have that. And he said, are you nuts? Everybody loves the tennis match. Everybody loves it. You have to have it. I didn't think that was very good logic. And I'm not
Nora
sure.
Loves it.
Nora loves it.
That should be the logic you need, right?
No, we just – it was the everybody who knows the book, you know, whatever. I didn't think then, and I don't think now, it was great logic. But there it is. It's stayed in the – you know, what I discovered, which maybe is if it's not unique, it must be pretty close, is that the writer kept begging the director on this movie to keep cutting and say, because it was like too many words, get rid of the words, too much, too talk. And he was so devoted to preserving, you know, those words that he, you know, sometimes I would win and get out a sentence or something, but.
Well, what a great collaboration that turned
out to be. It was very sweet. He was very deferential and at real pains to understand what the intentions were.
Yeah. So you finally had the chance to see the movie again years later for the 35th anniversary celebration at Gillette Tabret in Indiana. I guess it would have been about 4 or 5 years ago.
I did. I was invited by Stephen Doyle to come and give a talk or something. I think when directors look at their films, when authors reread their books, it's a little bit like looking at home movies of your life or something. You just see all the things that you did wrong, the close-ups that you didn't get, the line you wish were in, the line you wish was out. And it just never goes away. I watched David Lean being interviewed when I lived in London. They were talking about the bridge on the River Kwai.
Wow.
And the interviewer said, oh, I love the moment at the end where the doctor says, madness, madness. And David Lean says, I hate that moment. And we're all going, say what? What? And the interviewer said, you know, why did you hate that moment? And he says, because after the close-up of James Donald saying madness, madness, the producers put him on a plane back to London, and it's a double who walks away. And he doesn't like the way the double swings his arms. And that, like, every time he sees the movie makes him crazy. Yeah. One more story, because it's so great. And my dad said, you should never start a story by saying this is a great story, but you be the judge. I got to meet Paul Henry. We're standing outside the Motion Picture Academy on Wilshire Boulevard. Somebody introduces, and I'm standing there. I'm talking to Victor Laszlo. And I said, I have to tell you that when you tell the band to play La Marseillaise, I'm gone. I am sobbing like an infant. He says, I hate that moment.
What?
And I'm saying, what? Why do you hate that moment? I don't know if this is going to work on the radio, by the way, but he says, I hate it because I tell the band to play La Marseillaise and the band all goes like this.
And yeah, they look over.
Their heads all snap left in unison. And I say to Curtiz, who was the director, what are they looking at? And he says, we'll cut to a shot of Rick on the stairs and he'll nod, giving him the high sign it's okay to play. And Paul Heinrich getting steamed on the sidewalk of Wilshire Boulevard outside the Academy. He says, what? I'm Victor Laszlo. I'm leader of the resistance in the free world, and I can't get the band in a saloon at the ass end of nowhere to play La Marseillaise without they check with the barkeep? This is crazy! And Curtiz mumbles something about Bogey having nothing to do in the scene. He says, it's not my problem whether Bogey has anything to do with the scene. I'm Victor Laszlo. He's getting totally, you know, just going crazy on the sidewalk. So this is a preamble to my feelings about the movie of the 7% Solution, which over time had sort of calcified into a really objection to the screenplay of the movie, which I had grown to loathe because it had so many damn words in it. It just was like endless yakety yak. And I hadn't seen the movie for a long time. And that was my memory of it. So now here I am in Bloomington. Was it Bloomington?
Bloomington, Indiana. Yeah.
Bloomington. And I'm on this college campus and it's January, February. It's very cold. And I thought, okay, I introduced the movie, and then I'll go out and go to a coffee shop and read a book or something and come back at the end. But there was no coffee shop. There was no place to go. And there was – it was just this state-of-the-art movie theater on the, on this campus, and that was it. So – and it was very cold. So I sat there, and I was in a very pleasant state of shock that the movie was not as bad as my calcified recollection. And there were still moments that I'm wincing or whatever, but I thought, you know what? It may be a lot of talk, but it's very funny. And it's smart talk, and you have nothing to be ashamed of. So I stopped being ashamed of it.
Good for you. And, you know, it goes to prove your earlier point that memory is a funny thing.
It is a very funny thing. You know, people who reviewed that movie, and my favorite review was Vincent Canby, New York Times, said, "This is the most exhilarating entertainment of the film year." And I thought, why did you forget that? Why did you forget that, you know, I got so hung up on the battles I'd lost with Herb, because as I watched the movie get made and I saw how many words there were, and I became a much better screenwriter when I started directing. When I did Time After Time, I understood the ratio that was really possible, and when things stopped being cinematic and just got very talky.
Yeah.
And I, as I say, the forgivable thing is that, okay, it's pretty good talk, but it would have been even better. You could have done the same with less. When Stravinsky, to take a grandiose but relevant example, when he did the original Firebird, it had a huge orchestra. And then in 1919, when most of the musicians were dead, he reorchestrated it for a much smaller ensemble. And he said, I could get the same effect using fewer players. And that's sort of what I felt. It could have been, it would have been an even better movie.
Understandable. But ultimately, you know, as the artist, as the artisan, you were wrapped up for so very long in the process, whereas the audience, they only get that end result. They only see the fruits of all of that labor, whereas you put all the sweat and the tears and everything into it. So very different perspective with the same end result, evidently. But your point is well taken after having learned the craft and having fine-tuned your skill set.
You can't win those battles, I'll tell you. When Prokofiev did the ballet of Romeo and Juliet, originally they live. And the reason that they live, okay, is that corpses can't dance. So if you're doing a ballet, you know, it was like easier to, you know. But audiences, this is an important point, audiences may be stupid, but they're never wrong.
Right.
And so people said, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing? This is Romeo and Juliet. So they had to put it back with the right ending.
Sure.
I'm not sure I remember the relevance of this story, but anyway, it's a good story. And you, all the sweat and the tears go on. You don't see that. You see the end result. And,
right.
Hope that people just swallow it whole, and they don't know this whole speech could be just snipped out of the movie with scissors. Just snip it out. Just snip it out. Move the thing along.
So speaking of moving along, what are you up to these days?
Well, I did this Houdini movie that was on for two nights with Adrian Brody on the History Channel. I wrote that. And the History Channel cut it to ribbons. But you
Speaking
can get
of
it,
editing.
you can get it on DVD. It's considerably better on DVD. So they call it the expanded version, but what they really mean as the overseas version. So I did that. That was about a year ago. And I'm working on a television series called Freud, The Secret Casebook. And the idea was that Frank Spotnitz, who's doing The Man in the High Castle, came to me 8 years ago and said, let's do a remake of The 7% Solution. This is at least 8 years ago. And I said, okay, we dreamt up this idea. And we had to go to Universal because they own it. And we went to this lady executive who was in charge of all Universal. And they had IMDb back then. And she could have looked up the movie and found out what it was. But that didn't seem to be on her mind very much. So we go in there, and I remember she chewed gum through the whole meeting. She said, well, what's this about? And I said, well, it's about how Sherlock Holmes goes to Sigmund Freud to be cured of his cocaine addiction, and then they combine force. She goes, wait a minute. Drugs? About drugs? We can't do drugs. George Bush was president. We can't do drugs. So the meeting was a 5-minute meeting. Wow. And we were out on the parking lot in the valley saying, what was that? And shot down. That was the end of it.
This is like your literary agent who claims she never read any Sherlock Holmes books.
Yeah. Well, the older you get, that's another story. I'll tell you in a minute, but I'll finish this one. But we stayed friends. And, about 2 years or more ago, we're talking, and one of us said, why do we need Sherlock? Sigmund Freud helps the Vienna police solve crimes and invents psychoanalysis as a result of some of the cases that he's dealing with, applying, obviously, the Holmesian methods that he
– Sure. And
so we're trying to sell that.
Oh, that's great. What a great idea.
We have the first two scripts. They're pretty good. I was going to tell you this other. I said
I interjected with the literary agent. You said the more you learn.
Oh yeah, so I had a friend who had a birthday party recently, and it was a big number. And his wife said, can you give a talk can you say something at his birthday? And I said, well, here's what I. This is the paraphrase of what I said. I said, a lot of people are going to tell you that being this age is like a really bad thing, and that old age is, and your joints are going to go, all that stuff. I said, but I'm going to tell you a piece of good news. Everything that could possibly happen to you in your whole life has already happened. So you can relax because you are prepared for anything. And when they tell you that they're taking your film away from you and they're going to recut it, and they did with Houdini, I said, wait a minute, this happened to me on the day after. I remember I was, I was away from that movie for 3 months before they let me back in to put it back together. And so it's like, been fired, oh yeah, that happened to me, Been hired, oh yeah, I remember that. Been married, yeah, divorced, whatever. It all happened. And I've now reached the age where, short of being nuked, I've had all the experiences.
There you go.
And that's very comforting.
You've had the experience of being on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. So what else is there to live for, really?
Are you telling me I should pack it in?
No.
I'm telling you, you should come to the BSI weekend and do this in person with us.
Oh, yeah.
I actually made up my mind this morning that I was going to fly in.
Good. Excellent.
Yeah, I just wrote to Mike and said, how much is it again? It's a tuxedo, right? It's black tie?
Yeah, we got to stuff you into a tie again. Here's another one of those occasions.
See?
Thank your mom.
Experiences just repeat.
That's it. It all comes full circle. This is great.
Fabulous. Well, we'll look forward to seeing you.
Well, thank you. I will... if I can get on the plane and do the rest of it, I'll be there.
Good. Well, thanks so much for taking the time, you know, to sit with you and to remember this milestone, 7% solution, and what it kicked off, and to get your perspective and your stories and what you learned from it and how it connected with your past is absolutely unbelievable. So we owe you. This has been great.
I was extremely flattered by the interview and by the idea that a whole issue of this journal is being devoted to it. Again, I'm having a dissociative experience. Like, is this happening to me or whatever? But it's nice. It's really nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. Then I can dispense with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave mental exaltation.
Welcome to the I Hear Sherlock Everywhere quiz program called Mental Exaltation. If you've ever listened to NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or Weekend Edition Sunday with Puzzle Master Will Shortz, you'll be familiar with our format. But just in case you haven't listened to those, here's how it goes. Each episode, we post a qualifying question on our website at IHearOfSherlock.com. And of all the correct answers submitted, an individual will be chosen at random to become our contestant on Mental Exaltation. We vary the format of the quiz show, so on some episodes you have guests who will be put to the test, and on other occasions we have our guests who will be playing on behalf of the contestants. So, in this case, Nick Meyer will be playing on behalf of Nathan from New York, New York. Nick's hometown. This is highly appropriate, I would say.
There's hot dogs in it somewhere.
That's right.
Yeah, there we go. We'll be out on Coney Island. So, Nick, you wrote, as we've been discussing, the Sherlock Holmes novel, The 7% Solution. So we're going to ask you three questions about Sherlock Holmes and the number 7. Answer two of them correctly, and you will win the prize on behalf of Nathan. And the prize, by the way, is a copy of The 7% Solution. Are you ready?
Does the phrase sweating bullets mean anything to you?
Well, fortunately, this is audio, so we can't see it. All right, first question. If I said to you 9 to 7, and you responded by saying 7 to 5, who are we? A, Scotland Yarders in The Sign of Four. B, Scourers in The Valley of Fear. Or C, Mormons in A Study in Scarlet. 9 to 7, 7 to 5.
I'm going to go with B, but I don't know.
The Scourers in the Valley of Fear?
Yeah.
Oh, in this case, it was the Mormons in Study in Scarlet.
I knew that was the exchange
they went back and forth.
Okay.
So, all right. Well, we got two more chances, so pay close attention and we'll get there for Nathan. What is the 7th story in the collection of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes? A, The Blue Carbuncle. B, The Noble Bachelor. Or C, The Dancing Men.
What did I say last time? B? I'll go with A. I'll just say A.
A is correct.
A is correct.
Blue Carbuncle. Very good. All right. So you're 1-1. This is your last chance to get one right for Nathan.
Oh, this is exciting.
It's all down to the wire now. I know. He's taking his glasses off, wiping the sweat from his brow. This is it. This is it. And based on what you've said in the interview, we'll see how this one goes over. The 7th Sherlock Holmes film starring Basil Rathbone, The Spider-Woman, features a climax in which Dr. Watson almost unknowingly kills Sherlock Holmes. Where is this climax set? A, the Reichenbach Falls. B, the shooting gallery at a local carnival? Or C, the bridge of the USS Enterprise?
Okay, come on. All right. Where was A again?
A was the Reichenbach Falls.
No, that's B. It's got to be B. I never saw a thing that where they went to the Reichenbach Falls. Did they ever go to the Reichenbach?
You never saw the one where they were on the bridge of the USS Enterprise? No.
I saw one where Spock quotes Holmes on the bridge of the USS Enterprise.
That is true.
And actually claims descent from
right.
Holmes.
My ancestors.
Ancestors, right. Did you have anything to do with that?
Yes.
Right. So now we know. All right. Well, anyway, you are right.
You've won.
You've won. Nathan has won. So thank you very
Excellent.
Much for doing that. Nathan will be a happy camper.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
How about that?
Hmm.
Quite a storyteller.
Always a wonderful storyteller. You know, you think about the motion picture industry, and you think about people who go to film school and become directors and do actors. But there's so few people who've had such a rich career for such a long time as a screenwriter, as a novelist, as a director. And you can see it's his prodigious storytelling ability that just makes him a fabulous conversationalist. I just love that. I just wish we'd had more time. I would have liked to have talked to him about Time After Time and about some of his other work. But it's great that he'll be coming to the BSI in January, hopefully. So
yeah, maybe we can talk to him more on that occasion about some of those other works.
Yeah.
Since those are non-Sherlockian, they wouldn't be as of great interest to our listeners. So we use that for a personal indulgence.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to need to start a new podcast for that.
Yeah, please. This one is plenty.
But, you know, you think about it. I mean, 1975 to, say, you know, 1991, 1990s, Star Trek, his own scripts, Time After Time, H.G. Wells, 7% Solution, the novels. You think about just in those 20 years how much the tastes of the movie consumer changed, how much the writing style changed, how much the film industry changed. He's just terrific.
He is. And wonderful to hear, the Houdini tie-in there. Certainly the tie-in with Freud as well. But, Houdini and Doyle, that has been something that's been on the mind lately with a number of productions and books and whatnot. Of course, Dan Stasauer did the wonderful book about Houdini. So it's nice to see all of these common interests being woven together once again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of weaving things together, I guess this is the time that we weave together the end of the show.
Oh, hallelujah.
I know, right? Well, before we go, folks, don't forget, get on over to iTunes and give us a review and a rating if you haven't already done so. Those of you that have, we've seen them coming in, and it's making a difference, but we want to help bring the podcast to more people. We want to help them discover it, and the way to do that is to provide more ratings and reviews. So really appreciate your effort in that. If you've done so already, thank you. If you haven't, cajole someone you know that listens to the show into doing so. Cajole someone that doesn't listen to the show into doing so. Even better.
Mm.
Right? Because they'll have far better ratings for us than any of our actual listeners.
That's right. Although what you have to be careful not to do is to cajole somebody into doing a review, because
cajole.
Then you're going to be on the phone to Irving looking for a thong.
Hey, I'm glad we now have two 2,000-year-old man references into the show. Nick was quite a sport. But yeah, and then also check out Patreon if you so desire. We appreciate your effort in supporting the show. One final thing. This is worthy of noting. We are officially registered as a limited liability corporation.
Oh, excellent.
Isn't that neat? We are now iHose Media. So as much as we wanted to avoid the vernacular, calling ourselves IHOs in the early days. We've gone for the truncation of the word, and we're okay with that. We're okay with being IHOsers.
As a holding company. And also in future episodes, folks, particularly next year, we're going to take you to IHO's R&D laboratories when you'll be getting an inside look at some of the wonderful things we're working on, like the new IHO's nose flute that I'm sure is going to be a big hit with consumers, and also play memorable tunes from most Sherlock Holmes movies and television programs. Ah, sneak preview there.
It's tough to do a trill on the nose flute. Oh, that'll be fun. And expect the IHO's R&D labs to be underwritten by your favorite, the Sherlock Holmes brand of merchandise.
Yes, those beavers. They're just beavers, those people.
Well, I suppose this is the part. This is it. When we say, you're Bert Walder.
Oh, my goodness, you knew. And you're...
Right?
That's exactly right. And you are Scott Monte.
Excellent. And together, we say...
The game's afoot!
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.
Take a shower and put on my suit and tie and direct the last shot wearing a suit and tie. I got cast in a movie because of that.
See, there you go.
Oh, which picture were you cast in?
I was cast in the Mae West story. I played the young George Raft. I had one line. Oh. We were finishing shooting Star Trek II. This is like January. And we're just doing little close-ups of hands flicking switches and video displays, kind of pick-me-up shots winding down. And in those days, before there were smartphones or cell phones or wherever they were, there was a phone on a stand in every soundstage, and it had a little light, and the light would blink because they didn't want to make any sound. All during the shooting of this movie, which was only the second movie I'd ever directed, that phone would be blinking, you know, but to paraphrase John Donne, it never blinked for me, if you know what I mean. And as the movie was going on, as you get toward the end, the crew are all on that phone lining up their next gig.
Mm.
So on this particular day, my first AD comes over and says, phone for you. And I go, hey, it's for me. And he says, yeah. So I go over, I say, hello. And it's a casting director that I know named Tony Howard. And she says, Nick, hi, it's Tony Howard. How you doing? I say, I'm good. You know, what's going on? And she says, well, do you still act? And that was like a trick question because she didn't know I'd ever tried to be an actor in my life. It was just like she was going someplace. And it was like, when did you stop beating your wife? It was that kind of question. And so I said, yeah, sure. What do you mean? And she goes, well, I wonder if you'd be interested in playing a small role in a movie I'm casting as the young George Raft. You know, and the AD coming back over to me now and saying, you know, they're ready for you. I said, I'm on the phone here. Can you see that I'm on the phone? Yes, you guys were all on the phone for the last month and a half. This is my phone call. You guys just, like, you know, act like you're doing something. I'm sorry, Tony, what were you saying? And she says, well, you know, we'd like you to play this role. It's very small. I said, how small? She said, well, it's one line. I said, perfect. That's perfect. I could handle a line. And then I said, I'm sorry, but why did you call me up for this? And she said, well, somebody snapped a photo of you in your suit on your way to the opera, was it? On the set? And your hair was all slicked back because it was wet? You took a shower, something? Because you look like sort of George Raft. I said, really? And they say, we're ready for you over here. I said, will you just – oh, thank God. Sorry, Tony. What were you saying about me looking like George Raft? She said, well, you know, George Raft was brought out as a tango dancer to be a replacement for Rudolph Valentino. He was a Valentino lookalike. I said, are you saying that when my hair is wet, I look like Rudolph? And we went from there. So I don't know how we got onto this story from Jules Verne, but
it's a good story.